Welcome to the Delling Pod with me, James Dellingpole. And I know I always say I'm excited about this week's special guest, but look who I've got. Finally, Dr. Peter McCullough. Peter, it's fantastic having you on the podcast. You are one of the heroes of the struggle. So thank you for all you've done. I think most people will know who you are because, I mean, you've been on Joe Rogan and stuff like that. But And I don't want you to sort of just go over too much old ground. I want you to sort of take us forward to where we are now. But for a moment, think back to January 2020, say. I imagine that you never figured that the world would go the way it has. You are a very successful, distinguished doctor. You're an eminent cardiologist. You've published loads and loads of papers. Tell us about your credentials before we move on.
Well, thanks for having me on the program. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough, practicing internist and cardiologist in Dallas, Texas, trained in epidemiology. I spend about half my time in clinical practice and half as a clinical scholar and author, previously the editor of two journals. And you're right, I focused on the interface between heart and kidney disease and have made contributions to medicine over the course of many decades. I never anticipated that COVID-19 would come in and turn our lives upside down academically, but it really was a call to arms for doctors to come forward with approaches to save as many lives and spare as many hospitalizations as possible. And that's where I've been working and focusing on over the last few years.
Yeah. Well, your profession, I'm sorry to say, has not covered itself in glory in the last 2 months. I mean, with notable exceptions like yourself, I have completely lost my faith in not just doctors, but well, I obviously would have been misplaced, but I did not believe quite how evil Big Pharma was. I trusted the institutions which are supposedly there to protect us from medical malfeasance, none of which have done their jobs. Why do you think it is that so many doctors who, after all, you know, they're sort of bound by the Hippocratic Oath, they become doctors to try and save people. How come they become part of this massive scam?
Doctors, as you've indicated, have abrogated their Hippocratic Oath for each and every patient to honor the fiduciary relationship. Each patient, particularly those with severe symptoms, or those who are at high risk for hospitalization and death, and that's now entirely predictable based on medical problems, each of those patients who called out for help from their doctors and ended up in the hospital or worse, lost their lives, were effectively denied early treatment. If you look at the manuscripts, there's no mention of early treatment in these large cohorts of hospitalized individuals. On the other hand, there were smaller numbers of doctors who early on learned how to innovate. You know, I'm broadcasting today from Nassau in the Bahamas, and I've been working with Bahamian doctors throughout the week, and will be leading a large major seminar tonight at the Church of God here in Nassau, Bahamas, where we expect thousands of individuals to attend. I've met with doctors through the entire week. And here on the archipelago of islands, you know, they have 17 islands, only two with hospitals, and they have a population of 400,000 people here. If they didn't provide early treatment, they had nothing else for a lot of these people on the island. And now we know early treatment is in many ways, simple things that can be done at home, including virucidal nasal washes and oral gargles with dilute hydrogen peroxide or dilute povidone iodine. There's nutraceuticals and supplements that make an impact, including vitamin D, exquisite relationship between vitamin D and positive outcomes in COVID-19. And then lastly, there are available oral antivirals, corticosteroids, and anticoagulants that we use in combination to get people through the illness. So early treatment has been a story all over the world. It's been collaborative. I emphasized last night on national TV here in the Bahamas that early treatment is not an alternative. It's actually a standard of care, whether individuals have been vaccinated or not, since both groups are getting COVID-19.
Yeah. Even as a non-doctor, I have to say this ought to be a no-brainer. That if people are getting this potentially fatal illness, that it's important to start treating them early rather than waiting for them to reach crisis point where they have to be rushed to hospital, end up being put on a ventilator, end up being given drugs which don't work at the late stage, and they die away from their loved ones. You've made this point very, very well and very movingly. I still don't understand how this was allowed to happen, how so many doctors went along with this monstrous charade.
I think it was driven out of fear initially when doctors knew their societies and their hospitals were not asking them to get right in the firing line of sick patients with COVID-19, that they could sit back and let the patients come in to the hospital and let the hospital handle the sterility issues and the contagion control at the level of hospitalization. When the doctors realized that that was the operating protocol, it was relatively easy for them to step back from early treatment and tell patients, listen, early treatment doesn't exist. Go to the hospital if you're sufficiently sick. And that just led to more and more casualties. We learned early on and showed it very well in publications. I have a publication recently in the Medical Monitor with Fazio and colleagues from Italy that the golden window for treatment is the first 3 days of symptoms in high-risk patients. And it really doesn't matter the specific protocol. You know, there are protocols that use no hydroxychloroquine, no ivermectin, no antiviral effects of the illness, and they get people through it. There's other protocols that really heavily feature the antivirals. No drug is necessary nor sufficient to treat COVID-19. We use about 4 to 6 drugs in combination.
You mentioned earlier vitamin D, and I'll give you an example of the kind of the collective evil that I think has afflicted the world in these last 2 years. So a British newspaper, the Mail on Sunday, one of the biggest selling tabloids, ran this article pouring scorn on vitamin D supplements, saying that it was, you know, effectively it was a waste of time. And it was, the article heavily quoted this professor who has been very much on the kind of COVID establishment bandwagon. Now, what's your view of that when newspapers publish articles like that?
I think it's what's called malfeasance, which is wrongdoing by those in a position of authority, or propaganda, which is actually false information put out by those in position of authority. There's no reason to attack vitamin D. We're not saying it's a cure. We're not saying it's an acute therapy. All I'm saying is that there are analysis after analysis, including some randomized trials and a meta-analysis, that demonstrate that patients who are replete with vitamin D, and we're talking about serum levels of 50 or greater, have almost a zero chance of severe COVID or hospitalization or death. I have to tell you, I think we have to pay attention to those relationships. Why not? There appears to be no toxicity with vitamin D. Probably added supplementation for those in the UK at about 5,000 international units a day, maybe less so down here in the Caribbean. Why not? It falls into the category of why not give it a shot, given the severity of what COVID-19 has meant to so many individuals in society.
Yeah. Do you feel a bit like one of those ordinary guys who's suddenly been mugged by reality? Because I've noticed that in successive interviews you've given, you've become more radical. Early on, actually, even in the course of the Joe Rogan interview, you became more radical. Because I imagine you started off having faith in the system, and little by little you've come to realize that there are some bad actors involved. I mean, many bad actors.
Well, we learned a lot about one bad actor, and that's Pfizer. Through the lawsuit against the FDA and Pfizer, led by attorney Aaron Seary, co-counsel Elizabeth Brem, the Public Health Professional Review Committee, of which I am leading that group of 30 health professionals, we've already seen the first tranche of data from Pfizer. Pfizer was hiring employees to handle the onslaught of safety records that were being submitted to Pfizer. Pfizer knew within 90 days of release of their product worldwide that there were 1,223 deaths. Within 90 days of release, 1,291 special adverse events of interest, tens of thousands of other reports pouring in. Pfizer's hiring more employees, and Pfizer didn't shut it down. Typically 50 deaths with any product unexplained within initial release. The product is pulled off the market, usually voluntary recall by the manufacturer to figure out what went wrong.
Yeah.
You know, maybe allergenicity, there was a problem there. Maybe it was a problem in manufacturing. Maybe it was unique special populations who are now getting exposed and losing their lives quickly with the vaccine. But whatever was going on, it wasn't good. And Pfizer continued. To this day, Pfizer's still on the market. And in some places, people are mandated to take it.
Well, you've gone on the record. You initially said 50%, and then I think you raised the figure to 85%. You said 85% of all those who died supposedly of or with COVID were needless deaths. Who do you think is responsible? Who should we blame for this? I mean, it's essentially a massacre, isn't it? It's a public health massacre. Who's responsible for this?
Well, you know, I'd like the opportunity to get the numbers secured in the federal and state testimony. So on November 19th, 2020, at roughly 200,000 deaths, my testimony was that half of those deaths could have been saved with early combination, what's called sequence multi-drug therapy, now copyrighted the McCullough protocol at that time, because there was a learning curve. Right. So that you know, that was the percentage avoidable hospitalizations and death. I upgraded that March 10th of 2021 in the Texas Senate because we learned more. We had now published outcome studies. We had data from Didier Rialt, Matthew Lagier in Matthew Million in Marseille, Italy, Vladimir Zelenko in Monroe, New York, and then Brian Proctor here in Dallas, Texas. Demonstrating that the methods worked. So we knew we had fair comparative prospective data suggesting that the multi-drug therapy in fact worked. So in Texas Senate, I testified 85% of the hospitalizations and deaths could have been avoided. Now on January 24th, 2022, since the majority of hospitalizations and deaths now occurred during the vaccinated era, and we learned those vaccinated get equally sick with COVID compared to the unvaccinated, that we now estimated that 95% of all hospitalizations and deaths were avoidable. And so I think responsibility for these avoidable deaths were all those who worked to suppress early treatment, whether it be overtly or covertly. So let me give you an example of an overt suppression of treatment. The American Medical Association, which is effectively a political action committee for doctors, announced an open campaign to abolish the use of ivermectin. Abolish use. They wanted to abolish the use of one of the drugs. Now, we can treat it without ivermectin, but ivermectin certainly is useful, supported by over 70 studies, by over 35 randomized trials that show a signal of benefit, acceptable safety, about a 55% overall effect size. You know, there are laws in some states where the pharmacist must dispense ivermectin at the prescription of a doctor. And now in one state in the United States, over the counter, to give you an idea. So the American Medical Association and all the societies that put out statements stating not to treat COVID-19, that would also include the NIH, the FDA, they had statements that basically effectively were telling doctors not to use specific drugs, in a sense trying to pull out the linchpin of early treatment. And they never updated their recommendations. So a statement against hydroxychloroquine in June of 2020, was never updated when more data poured in. Same thing with NIH statements against ivermectin in 2021. They were never updated. We now have had monoclonal antibodies. Monoclonal after monoclonal in the United States have been pulled off the market based on theoretical studies based on in silico sequencing of variants, not based on clinical data. And so they've been pulled off the market. Today, we've learned the rest of sotrovimab has been pulled off the market. We have a blend of BA1, BA2 subvariants of Omicron. We now have XE, XD, XF. We don't know if these monoclonal antibodies have lost their effectiveness. All I can tell you is every randomized trial of monoclonal antibodies continues to show that they're safe and effective. There should be no withdrawal of these drugs from the market. So all of these characters that continue to try to take away therapeutic options to patients have been really, you know, overtly involved in the suppression of early treatment. And it's cost lives. It's resulted in needless hospitalizations.
And where ultimately do you think they're taking their orders from? Because, I mean, after all, some of these associations are made up of doctors like yourself. Some of these, their express job is to protect the consumer from medical malpractice and inappropriate drugs. And yet here they are denying sick people a means of survival. So where's this, who is ultimately to blame?
There's a couple of terms that are important, certainly in the United States. One is called emergency countermeasures. It's almost like an FBI term, but emergency countermeasures means in COVID-19, as long as an emergency is declared, there are countermeasures that are taken and can be taken really without any question. And that includes the distribution of large sums of money to hospitals for various activities, for taking care of COVID patients, for supply chain, for various drugs and other equipment that's needed. But also FAQs that say, follow these talking points about promoting mass vaccination, suppressing early treatment, removing monoclonal antibodies from use, not allowing the formulary installation and utilization of antivirals as an example, not offering patients any information on early treatment. These are all part of these emergency countermeasures, and through a process called, the second term is called regulatory capture. Once money starts to flow to these institutions and they have agreed to accept the money, boy, they better follow the talking orders. So the talking orders are flowing in the United States from the federal government. Elsewhere, they're probably flowing from the World Health Organization, all the local health authorities in the United Kingdom. You have the MHRA involved. It's pretty clear that these regulatory agencies are completely ignoring calls from the clinical community with concerns on vaccine safety. So the MHRA is, in particular, has received a report in June of 2021 from the evidence-based consulting group. It was about a 24-page report. I've read it. I have it in my files. That clearly told the MHRA, based on the yellow card system, that the vaccines used in the UK, Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca, are not safe for human use. The safety reports are too concerning. There's too many citizens of the United Kingdom who have lost their lives due to the vaccine, due to fatal vaccine injury syndromes. And yet, the MHRA has turned a blind eye to safety, and more citizens of England, Scotland, and Ireland continue to be injured by the vaccines.
So suppose I'd been conned by the government into taking the vaccine and I'd suffered vaccine injuries. Who would I have a case against? Because as I understand it, the drugs companies have all indemnified themselves. I mean, the MHRA surely ought to have been warning me about this stuff, but clearly it hasn't. So where is this coming from? I mean, who's telling these people? Is it the World Health Organization? Is it, I mean, Patrick Vallance, for example, you presumably must be familiar with him. A lot of the people high up in our regulatory authorities who have been pushing vaccines have a cozy relationship with the big pharma industry. So, I mean, is it about money? Is it about China? Is it about what?
You know, one of the best books to read on this, I'm not an expert, about the really complicated relationships that are out there executing this mass vaccination program, but one of the best books to read is by Peter and Ginger Bregan. It's called COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey. I wrote one of the introductions along with Dr. Lee Fleet and Vladimir Zelenko. But the cast of characters in the open includes all the vaccine manufacturers, includes the U.S. National Institutes of Health, the U.S. FDA, the U.S. federal government, the Eco Health Alliance, yeah. Gavi, CEPI, the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, World Health Organization, World Economic Forum, and the Chinese Communist government. It's complicated, but what Bregan says is that everything's in the open. So when Klaus Schwab published the book, The Great Reset, where he says we're going to use COVID-19 as the opportunity to reset the global world, when President Biden a few weeks ago said, yes, COVID-19 is the opportunity to reset a new world order, they meant it. And when there is talk about worldwide digital currency, social credit scores, digital passports, all linked to taking a genetic injection every 3 or 6 months. They mean it. It's in the open. The Bragan book, for instance, people say, well, how could they get the vaccine so quickly? Well, if you want to see how Moderna had the plans and was working on the patents and electronic in order to provide a vaccine against the SARS-CoV-2 virus, long before the virus is even known or released from the lab, you can see all that. It was all well orchestrated far ahead of time.
Yeah.
And so the general principle here is don't look for any secret documents. You don't need to. Everything is in the open. Everything's being telegraphed to you. Even on vaccine safety, in the United States, the consent form says the vaccines can result in death. It says right on the consent form. Every single person that took the consent form, you can imagine someone takes the vaccine and they die. Their family members are furious. They look at the consent form and say, listen, we told you, it's right there. Everything's in the open.
Wow. Yeah, that's really shocking, isn't it? I was just wondering, if going back to January 2020 again, if you could have heard yourself in 2 years in the future or 2.5 years in the future talking about what you've just been talking about now, would you have been astonished?
I would. Yeah, I've always said, boy, if you had about 3 to 5 years to take a sabbatical and just, disenroll from life and you know, go sail the ocean or something, boy, that would be the time to do it, because we're on our third year of this.
Yeah.
COVID-19 is at record lows. We have very good treatments. Down here in the islands, they've had one or two cases and it's basically not an issue down here.
Yeah.
Yet the fear is extraordinary. Everyone's, asking for various records and et cetera. The fear is through the, so the fear is much greater than the reality.
Yeah.
And, I've had some antagonistic interviews. I had one down here from a young man and it's all about the vaccine. And I said, listen, I was never afraid of the virus. And obviously his eyes were big as saucers. He was incredibly fearful of the virus. So the fear is out of proportion. Young people who are healthy and fit should have no fear of this. They shouldn't have any fear of the common cold. However, someone who has emphysema, who lives in a nursing home, is already on oxygen, has heart failure and diabetes, obesity, that person should have some concern.
Yeah.
So the concern ought to be with what the risk is. Looking at you, James, you're young, you're fit, you look very healthy. You shouldn't walk around in fear of COVID-19.
Yeah. I'm not afraid. I am afraid though of the vaccines. I was wondering, am I right in thinking that you've had the vaccine yourself? And do you have any regrets about that?
I haven't, because I had COVID early in 2020. So I had the clinical illness. Remember, the vaccines are only indicated for people who have not had COVID to prevent COVID, right? So it's too late for me to receive a vaccine. So everybody who's already had COVID, it's too late to receive a vaccine. And we have multiple studies that if they take one anyway, that they actually have increased rates of side effect. And one of my fears is that all of these deaths and vaccine injury syndromes, are a lot of them are probably occurring in people who didn't need the vaccine. They've already had COVID. And those people were excluded from the clinical trials. Maybe the reason why the clinical trials look safe is because COVID recovered people were excluded from those trials. And now the vaccines look so unsafe in the public program is because they're vaccinating in people on top of who've already had the clinical illness.
Yes, I can see that. So if you say you were speaking to a young person who'd had COVID and was healthy anyway, and they were thinking of taking the vaccine in order to be able to travel, what would you say to them?
I tell them, listen, don't take an experimental product, a medicinal product that you can't get out of your body. You can't stop the consequences that's going to happen once it's injected. Don't do that for social reasons.
Yeah.
Now, if there was a compelling medical reason, if that person had never had COVID and they had cystic fibrosis and they had a very tenuous pulmonary situation, it could be a different discussion. But we shouldn't swallow any pill we shouldn't take any injection for social reasons, whether it be travel, employment, education. We don't take pills in order to go to school. We don't take pills in order to be able to do things in life. We shouldn't be putting medicinal products, let alone genetic products, in our body for social reasons.
Yes. Well, you must have been, I mean, you're a cardiologist. You must have seen an increased number in cases of myocarditis and things like that. I mean, tell me the situation.
There's no doubt about it. In June of 2021, the CDC estimated 62 cases per 1 million individuals who received either Pfizer or Moderna. Then Tracy Hoag from the University of California, Irvine, has now fully published an estimate that was probably double that, that in fact the rates were much higher. Now Scharf and colleagues from Kaiser Permanente in Northern California have estimated in males age 18 to 24, the rate is over 500 cases per million. So we're talking about an urban area of 2 million people. There's going to be 1,000 cases of myocarditis. And the heart injury that we're learning about looks like it's sustained. So now in two papers by Schauer and colleagues in the Journal of Pediatrics have shown that the late gadolinium enhancement, which is the marker of damage and scarring in the hearts of these young men largely, doesn't go away. And it certainly doesn't go away in the course of several months. So it's not mild and it's not transient or self-limited. And so we're finding these cases. I'm seeing them in clinical practice. They do need drug support. They can absolutely not have any athletic activity because the athletic activity and the surge in adrenaline appears to be a trigger for cardiac death. And now a leading Brazilian physician, Flavio Catagiani, has a wonderful paper in preprint outlining the catecholamine trigger for the cardiac death that's occurring. And we think this is probably explaining some of these athletic deaths that we're seeing on the playing field. The European soccer and football leagues and rugby have all mandated the vaccines, and these young men have taken it. 90% of myocarditis in men is probably related to some androgen effect on the heart as well, that there are record numbers of athletes who have actually died on the field. They have sudden cardiovascular collapse. About half of them are successfully resuscitated, half of them at the Miami Open tennis tournament this weekend. Unprecedented, 15 competitors had to drop out of the tournament. The tournament was mandating vaccination in all of them. We've never seen 15 people drop out of a tennis tournament. They practice the entire year for this. They train the entire year for this. Our insurance companies now, dozens of them, are reporting record mortality in working aged adults. And that's across US, Canada, and Europe. All of these have happened since the advent of ill-advised mass vaccination.
So given that all this is happening and it's in the public domain, I mean, although it's not being that well reported in the mainstream media, why is it that vaccine programs are still being allowed to continue, particularly vaccines for young people who presumably don't need it?
They're not very popular. I can tell you almost any vaccine center is completely empty. In the United States, they've been empty now since April then of 2021. And now there's been, there's a deluge of incentives, money, donuts, hot dogs, beer. Then there was $1 million raffles, free college scholarships. No one was taking these vaccines. They knew the vaccines are potentially deadly. And then the mandates came in and people felt forced into taking them. And that's the worst thing of all. When people feel forced to take something that they know is unsafe for their body and they sustain an injury, or even worse, the individual dies due to the vaccine, the family is furious. So now the opposition to vaccination is fierce, and there are rallies and major demonstrations occurring all over the world now. They know the vaccines are dangerous. They know they're deadly in some, and they feel they can't have their livelihood, everything they've worked for, be put on the line to take an injection that doesn't work against COVID. It doesn't seem to stop COVID at all and offers the risk of serious injury or death.
Yes. And am I right in thinking that all American colleges forced their undergraduates to have the vaccine before they were allowed in?
No, it was scattered. It was very scattered. Some did, some didn't. There's been an ephemeral nature to the vaccine mandates, requiring them at one time and then dropping them. There's been an incredible inconsistency. I live in Texas, one of the biggest and most populous states. In Texas, we only had four small private universities require vaccination, and they're tiny private universities. The big private universities like Baylor, my alma mater, Texas Christian University, SMU, University of Houston, and then the big state institutions, none of them required the vaccination. Many institutions have pulled back on vaccination. We've had major companies, for instance, Starbucks, GE, FedEx, recently MGM Studios Entertainment, big entertainment company, all dropped their vaccine mandate. So I think they're trying to read the tea leaves. They know they're unpopular. We have record low unemployment in the United States, so the labor market is very constrained, and people have just moved to jobs. People will literally leave a job and go to another one that doesn't require vaccination.
That's reassuring. But at the same time, am I right in thinking that the U.S. military is now entirely vaccinated and that there's been a massive increase in cardiac cases and things like that and deaths?
In the military, you're right. Let's take the latter first. The Department of Defense Epidemiologic Database, DMED, the results have been presented under U.S. Senate testimony by lead attorney Tom Renz, co-counsel Lee Dundas, with the whistleblower. And the lead whistleblower is flight surgeon Teresa Long. So this is all in the open. DMED is reporting a 2, 3, 4, and 5-fold increased risks of heart attacks, strokes, blood clots, cancers, fetal loss with pregnancies. And this is among enlisted, but also administrative personnel in the military in 2021 over prior years. The only thing that's new in 2021 is mass vaccination. And you're right, large numbers have taken the vaccine, but not all. In fact, all five branches of the military are being sued on multiple different cases right now because they have not honored exemptions for medical reasons. They haven't honored exemptions for religious reasons. And no one can be forced to take an injection against their will when they have a medical contraindication. That's tantamount to personal injury. And so, we're incredibly concerned about what's going on in the military. The vaccines don't make anybody healthier. They don't make the human body stronger. But there's now over 1,000 peer-reviewed papers, either in the preprint server system or in the National Library of Medicine, showing the vaccines make the body weaker and lead to a tremendous number of diseases. And even the European Health Agency has put out some statements suggesting progressive vaccination, particularly boosters, is just going to weaken the immune system. And it may explain what we see in the UK is what's called negative efficacy. The more vaccines people take, actually, the higher the risk of COVID and severe outcomes. And in a recent analysis by Bar-On from Israel, they're now reporting results after the fourth shot of Pfizer. And the second week after the fourth shot of people who took the fourth shot, they had 14,000 cases. After the third week after the fourth shot, they had an additional 9,000 cases. I mean, it's obvious the vaccines don't stop COVID. In fact, they actually may backfire and people may have a higher risk of COVID.
Tell me, when people come to you with cases of myocarditis, I mean, what do you say to them? Is there anything that can be done? I mean, or is it basically a death sentence or at least a shortened life sentence?
No, it's not a death sentence. The first point is don't take any more shots. Now, there's some people who take the first vaccine and the employer, particularly the military, is saying take the second shot. I've had someone in the military have myocarditis, and he's been told by his commanders he has to take the second shot. Believe it or not, I've had a patient who's had myocarditis, and it went all the way to cardiac transplantation. He got a new heart, and now the transplant center is telling him to take the second shot. And the first shot is actually what caused his heart failure with his native organ. So you can see how disturbed the thinking is here. It's like, no, we don't give products that have official warnings against with heart damage on them to people with heart failure. And we don't give any drugs or therapies that can cause heart damage to heart transplant recipients. We don't do that. I mean, you can see how disordered the thinking is. But in general, the approach, about 90% of the young people with myocarditis require hospitalization because of incipient heart failure or signs and symptoms of a progressive chest pain, damage, or arrhythmias. They need some stabilization. If the heart pumping function is down, they need drugs to support heart function and avoid heart failure. So that's largely ACE inhibitors, evidence-based beta blockers, and a combination product of valsartan or sacubitril that we use commonly, actually have good results. And then for the inflammation part of it, my practice pattern is to use a combination of an oral steroid and then another anti-inflammatory called colchicine, which we use for pericarditis. And we take treatment 3 months at a time, 3 months, 3 months, 3 months. Some people need 3, 6, 9 months of supportive treatment. I'm a little bit worried about the shower papers that have come out showing that the damage is persistent. So I just had a case recently who's about 9 months into it, and I've ordered another MRI because I'm worried that the damage is still ongoing and I can't detect it clinically. So,
is there anything that you've discovered that can undo the, I mean, obviously you can't undo heart damage, but is there anything you've discovered that can undo the damage done by vaccines generally?
No, that's the most frequent question I get is, I've taken the shot for social reasons. How do I get it out of my body? It's kind of like buyer's remorse. Yeah. And we were stunned to see a paper from Stanford by Holtgen and colleagues showing the messenger RNA is stuck in the lymph nodes easily for 2 months. So, and that's as far as they look. The messenger RNA may be in there much longer. I've published now several papers with Anthony Karagoglis from Athens, Greece, based on what we know on the vaccine. We think the genetic material is long-lasting. There's a recent paper by Marcus Aldrin from Malmo, Sweden, that's demonstrated for the first time reverse transcription of a center point of codes within the base code from Pfizer. So what's called the PCR amplicon is what they use to detect the signal. But that got into the human nucleus of a hepatic cell line model within about 6 hours. And they've identified what reverse transcriptase does. It's called line one. It's an endogenous reverse transcriptase. This is big trouble because if the messenger RNA vaccines permanently change human DNA and now at a low level express the dangerous spike protein, either constitutively or inducibly, and then this passes down from parent cells to daughter cells, this could be a terrible outcome for anybody who's taken one of the messenger RNA vaccines. So it needs a lot more confirmation that, in fact, this is happening. But many have looked at this and said, listen, enough is enough. Even the CDC says the vaccines don't alter the human genome. Now we have the first lab showing that, in fact, the vaccines have altered the human genome. And then there are now emerging sources of data on the spike protein, which is produced from the genetic vaccines. The spike protein damages organs, damages the brain, the heart, the lungs, the bone marrow. I've recently had on a doctor from Italy on the McCullough Report who thinks that each cell that expresses spike protein is fundamentally killed by the immune system. So there's widespread tissue destruction going on. That's the reason why people feel bad after the vaccines and have a variety of these post-vaccination ill-defined syndromes. Bruce Patterson, who runs the company InCell DX, formerly faculty at Northwestern and Stanford, has shown that the spike protein intact, S1 and S2, is in the human body almost certainly for over a year in those after the vaccine. The S1 segment's in the year over the body over a year after the respiratory infection as well. The respiratory infection and the vaccine have parallels, particularly the severe cases of the respiratory syndrome and the vaccine, because they both get large doses of the spike protein.
Is there any chance that this can infect unvaccinated people? I mean, could it mess with the DNA of or the mRNA of unvaccinated people?
You know, I don't think so. I get that question a lot about shedding by Banzel and colleagues showing the spike protein gets in exosomes, which are small phospholipid packets. So it's possible someone who took a vaccine, maybe within the first few weeks, if they cough or exhale, or it's in their oral or urogenital secretions, that they could, in a sense, spread the spike protein to a recipient. There may be some low-level effects to this. Maybe there are salutary effects. Maybe it's just generating some immunity in the recipient. But there still has not been a bona fide paper, scientific paper, published yet demonstrating shedding of the spike protein from one person to another causing a clinically important event. And so right now, the medical literature, we're about 250,000 papers on COVID-19. It continues to come out every day in the preprint server and in the peer-reviewed system. You know, I spend most of my professional time reviewing these papers as I'm a frequent commentator on almost all the major news stations in the United States. And now I'm down in the Caribbean. I'll be on the news within an hour here in the Bahamas as well. And I'm sure if I too, the world and particularly the U.S. government is relying on my analysis and people, in a sense, in a panel of doctors who are very academically distinguished. Scott Atlas, who was on this force, Jay Bhattacharya, Martin Kulldorff, Sunetra Gupta in the U.K. They're the authors of the Great Barrington Declaration. Harvey Risch, eminent professor from Yale. Kirk Milhome, pediatric cardiologist in Hawaii, MD, PhD. So there are doctors that Americans and people worldwide are looking to for a fair scholarly review of the information to guide us forward.
Right. Given what you said, I mean, I was pleased to see that there has been a kind of the beginnings of a backlash in the US that vaccine centers are empty and that people who've had relatives injured are angry and want redress. Are you sensing a dawning awareness among your colleagues, people who previously were all on board with it? Are they now realizing what's going on?
They are. I think it's slow for them to come around. Many are horrified that they actually were encouraging the patients to take the vaccine, and now patients have blood clots, heart damage, you know, all the things that the FDA has warnings on. We should just pay attention to the FDA and MHRA and TGA and EMA warnings. I mean, we don't have to, in a sense, come up with any new concerns. If we just follow the warnings, for instance, on myocarditis, we wouldn't give these products to young people because COVID-19 is a harmless illness in young individuals. So all we have to do is, in a sense, everything's in the open. All we have to do is just follow practice here. So people at risk for blood clots, for instance, who should a large number of papers describing venous thromboembolic events, some of which are fatal.
And it's bizarre, isn't it? Because like you've been putting the word out. Lots of people now are speaking the truth, and we've got the VAERS reports. We've got the yellow card reports in the UK showing a significant number of adverse events, more than would normally be allowed by the regulators, wouldn't it? I mean, it's shocking, the number of deaths and injuries.
Far more. In fact, if we follow conventional standards, all the vaccines would have been pulled off the market in February of 2021. They exceeded all the safety concerns. And things were in the open. People who continued to take the vaccine were, in a sense, taking their lives into their hands. And they still do so today. People who are taking, you know, but it is possible to take shot number one and shot number two and do fine and then die on shot number three. That's been described and published now. So there appears to be no one who's safe here. And I think it's an extraordinarily risky proposition to take one of these vaccines, particularly since we can treat COVID. COVID, we have more and more emergency use authorized products. So we have a much more refined approach with the virucidal treatment in the nose. We know that's safe and effective and works. Nutraceuticals and supplements, monoclonal antibodies keep shifting, but have them available. We have a new product in the United States that replaces a vaccine offered by AstraZeneca, and it's two shots of monoclonal antibodies that are long-lasting every 6 months. So we can use those in immunocompromised. They're not vaccines. So we have that as an approved approach. We have, the oral drugs we've relied on, we've already covered, but we have new drugs by Pfizer and Merck that are effective. I think the Pfizer drug is particularly effective, Paxlovid. Other drugs, no controversies involved with corticosteroids, intracellular antibiotics, aspirin, the anticoagulants. So we can always treat COVID. Why would we take a risk with a vaccine that's clearly not safe? And we are very disappointed with efficacy numbers, large numbers of people get COVID-19 just by taking as many shots as possible.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's hard, isn't it? So on the one hand, you've got people like you putting out this information, and you've got loads of evidence. On the other hand, we've got governments still pushing. I mean, my government is still pushing vaccines for children, despite all the evidence about, you know, children have started to die of heart conditions. It's bizarre, and they're trying to normalize it as though yeah, dying of myocarditis or whatever is a kind of perfectly natural thing for a child.
You know, I've testified under oath, U.S. Senate, January 24, 2022. One case of myocarditis in a child is too many. One case. Because yeah. Children otherwise are fine. If they get COVID-19, it's indistinguishable from the common cold. There are estimates in the U.K. that 85% of the children have already had COVID. So it's too late for them to get a vaccine anyway. We would never risk a vaccine in the children in the United Kingdom. Never. It would be irresponsible to do that, because yeah. The vaccines can only cause harm, and in fact do. And you're right. The health advisory research team, HART, in the UK in January did put in a formal request into UK authorities investigating a temporal uptick in mortality of teenage boys in the UK. So you've had a record number of teenage boys in the UK die during the era of vaccination in 2021, record number. I mean, it's a big uptick. And there shouldn't be, there should be very few boys in the UK who are 15 years old who are dying. And so that alarming report went into the UK authorities. I think the best thing parents can do is keep their, keep their children far away from these vaccines. They can't be injured by them if they don't take the shot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've made it my personal mission. Whenever I go riding, twice a week. And whenever I talk to the mothers, I say to them, you know, don't take the vaccine. And I think I've saved some children from, I've spared them the horror of being injected. And you must have, I bet you've personally saved, some of your patients would not be alive today had it not been for your early advice with your protocol.
Well, yeah, the protocol certainly has made a big impact. And I have kept track of my patients, and I see largely older people with heart, lung disease, and kidney disease, many with diabetes. My estimate is 70% of my patients early on, December of 2020, January, February, and maybe some degree of March of 2021, did take one of the vaccines. Now, after that, the rates of vaccination really tailed off. Remember, everybody who has not taken a shot since October 1st is unvaccinated. So the vast majority of my patients now are effectively unvaccinated. Most people I talk to who think they're vaccinated, in fact, are not, because they haven't kept up on these frequent boosters. So that's another thing to talk about. People say, well, I'm vaccinated. I was on a podcast with a young investment guy who's really fit and sharp. He'd be the last guy who needs a vaccine. And he told his audience almost as if he had two stripes on his coat. You know, I'm vaccinated. I said, no, you're not. He goes, what do you mean? I said, have you had a shot since October 1st? He goes, no. I said, you're as unvaccinated as I am. And he was just, you could see him just kind of deflate with that. So, people are not vaccinated unless they're keeping up on a frequent injection program. And almost no one's doing that. So listen, I'll have time just for one more question. I'm going to have to get on to my next appointment.
No, you're a busy man. You're a workaholic indeed. And you're fighting, you're doing the Lord's work. Yeah. My final question is, where do you think, when is all this going to end? When is reality going to hit home and the governments are going to surrender? They can't impose these things on the people anymore.
I think we're in this for many more years right now. The governments are not showing any signs of willingness to analyze the data, willingness to accept wrongdoing, willingness to actually just change course and say they're sorry about anything, about unnecessary lockdowns, masking programs that's failed, asymptomatic testing programs that have no scientific support, vaccine cards and registries that haven't worked. It goes on and on. I mean, it's so deep. One of the problems is it's so deep here. Almost every aspect of pandemic response has made the problem worse. It's going to be very unlikely that any officials are going to come clean. We're probably going to have to go through election cycles. We'll probably have to vote people out of office. others, individuals will probably have to be forced out of office, and we're going to need clean sets of leadership. Let me give an example. In Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis has brought in as his Surgeon General, been ratified, Joe Ladapo, who's a UCLA professor. Joe and I published one of the meta-analyses on hydroxychloroquine. He's clearly an early treatment a supporter. And they've called advisory teams. They've looked at the data. And DeSantis and Ladapo have officially announced no childhood vaccination in Florida. None. There's no government support for this. They will not allow schools to do it. No government agencies can do it. Now, on a special case-by-case basis, if a parent and, you know, children with pulmonary disease want to decide with their doctor and do it on a pretty rare case-by-case, they can do it. But you know, I think Florida is showing an independent approach here. And we'll see more of that as like-minded people get installed into office. There's been a narrative. There's been a government narrative. And, you know, in medicine, we don't talk in narratives. The word narrative means to tell a story. We don't tell stories. We're actually interpreting data and using inferential thinking to modify our conclusions moving forward. Americans had a chance to see me, Jay Bhattacharya, Scott Atlas, Harvey Risch, Kirk Milhone, Alex Diaz. They've seen a lot of this, and I think Americans now understand which doctors they really should trust, who have been honest, who have recognized when they've needed to change their interpretation of what's going on based on the data. And, you know, I've done that all the way through, and I think that's the reason why myself and you and so many people like us have really a large and growing following. People are turning off mainstream media. They know right now it is just chocked full of propaganda that's not trustworthy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks for all you do, and good luck with tonight's conference and with all your news work. And yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks so much. And you can follow me on America Out Loud Talk Radio, The McCullough Report. And also you can follow my Twitter feed, P_McCullough MD. And I update almost every day, 5 or 6 updates on that. And I have channels on Telegram, Facebook, and the other social media. But I can tell you, we've made huge progress. And thanks to the independent media and insightful, intelligent people like you, we've made great progress. I'll let that be the last word. Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.